annual convention of the American Cancer Society in San Francisco, a paper would be delivered identifying cigarette smoking as a primary cause of cancer. Now, this causes us to prick up our ears because our principal sponsor for the early evening news at the time was Pall Mall Cigarettes, American Tobacco Company product. I got a call at 4 o'clock or so one afternoon confirming that what we had expected had happened. As a matter of fact, a paper had been delivered at the American Cancer Society convention identifying cigarette smoking as a primary cause of cancer. And I was asked the question, you know, what do we do? And I said, obviously, you can't duck this kind of thing. You just got to do it. It's got to be covered, and they agreed that that was the way to do it. Said no additional histrionics, cover it straight, just as straight as you can possibly make it. But at that point, I thought it's pretty important to notify the television network what was coming in case there was any kind of an uprising from SSC and via the agency or the American Tobacco Company. I called Jack Van Valkenburg, the president of the television network, and told him what was coming and why we had to do it. I got no argument from him, but he said, you better call the agency, too, just to tip them off. So I called SSC&B and told them that we were going to carry the story. We saw no alternative to do it. They didn't argue. They said, send us a copy of it, and we'll be watching tonight, and that's as far as they went. So we carried the story, and, of course, we continued to carry it from that point on. Now, this, I think, is a fairly good illustration of one that we felt obligated to carry because it was news. And it would have been to our advantage, theoretically and superficially, if we had avoided it, but we didn't, because we couldn't. To look at it from another point of view, just after the 1956 Middle Eastern War, we sent a camera crew into the Middle East to pick up some of the pieces from that war. We did a half hour from Egypt, and a half hour from Syria, and a half hour from Kuwait. We found that Gulf Oil Company would be very interested in sponsorship through the agency Ketchum McLeod and Grove in Pittsburgh. And this seemed like a great idea. We hadn't really succeeded in selling very much of our serious programming. And so this was great. We'll assure them. They were principally interested in Kuwait. And it hadn't occurred to me, which I should have known, that Gulf Oil was a major investor in Kuwaiti oil. Well, when I found that out, it was on the day that the board of directors of Gulf Oil was meeting at the Pittsburgh Club in Pittsburgh to ratify the contract with us. So I picked up the telephone, I called the Pittsburgh Club, and asked for the agency representatives who were outside the board meeting, and said, sorry, we can't sell it to Gulf. Can you get inside the meeting and tell them that we can't, and back out of it? And they were very reluctant to do so because they'd been working hard in making this sale, but they did finally agree they would do it. When I explained why we couldn't possibly do it, they went in, the deal was off, and incidentally they very shortly thereafter signed a long-term deal for what they called instant news specials with NBC. But your original question was advertising pressure. I'm sure there was some at various points, but I didn't feel it. And any time it came, we were able to resist it.
Did they ask to preview documentaries before they were aired?
One case, yeah. We did one of the first, I guess probably the first so-called instant news special on the air, came when President Adenauer of the West German Republic took a trip to Moscow. Now, this really was quite a dramatic occasion. We were able to get a camera crew and the correspondent, Dick Hoddle, to go along with Adenauer and to do a fairly good job of filming. Now, we came out with the conclusion that this would make a pretty good half-hour show. At that time, Prudential was buying You Are There at 6:30 on Sunday nights, I believe. So we suggested the possibility that Prudential would preempt You Are There for one night and insert this Adenauer visit to Russia instead, to Moscow. Prudential was interested in it, but of course the worst thing in the world for a very conservative company to buy is a half-hour film report on the Soviet Union. So whereas they were willing to buy it, they were pretty skittish about the contents of the program. So we suggested to them that we'd let them have a look at the script in advance, If they saw anything offensive to them, they could remove their commercials, but they couldn't make any changes in it. And they bought it on that basis, and I'm sure they had some qualms about sponsoring it, but they did. And we converted the next year into the 20th century, so they stayed for a long time with CBS thereafter. So everything came out well. One more incident. We created a series, Eyewitness to History, out of these two Eisenhower trips that were mentioned earlier. Firestone bought them. And we went to Firestone suggesting they buy a weekly Saturday, Friday night show, 10:30 to 11, called Eyewitness to History, with the week's news done in summary. And that at the end of the year they buy a one-hour one, a 60-minute one. We succeeded in obtaining Firestone sponsorship, put Charlie Kuralt in as the narrator of the series, the central figure of the series. I came up to the year-end show, and Mr. Castro had taken over Cuba at this point, but still had not taken over the Firestone plant in Cuba, in which Firestone had a great deal of money invested. On New Year's Day, this would have been New Year's Day 1960, I guess, my telephone started ringing at about 9 o'clock in the morning, where the Firestone people saying, we want to change the following paragraphs in the script. I said, look, the agreement is you don't change anything. You can remove your sponsorship if you don't change. All right, how do I get Jim Aubrey, the president then of the television network? I told him how to get Jim Aubrey. How do I get Frank Stanton? Well, this conversation went on and on and on all day, and I had to call Les Midgley, who was producing the show, telling Les, look, you may have a show without Firestone sponsorship. Don't change your show, but you better have some additional material to add to round out the additional 6 minutes or whatever it is that Firestone has, so start producing it. And this literally went on right up to almost the moment the show was going to go on the air, when Firestone finally capitulated, and they said, we'll take it as is. The argument, of course, was, if we irritate Castro, they might lose their plant. Well, they lost the plant, but they're probably going to lose it anyway. This was pressure, but we stood up and we won on it. But we were prepared to take their commercials out and go ahead with the show without their commercials.
On the other side of the coin, my other question deals with the selection of topics for CBS reports. Did Friendly and the people who worked under him have autonomy in selecting topics? Did you or other people in senior management approve those topics or approve them in script form?
Well, there isn't any one single system. I normally talk with Fred about topics before he froze on them. Fred was a person who researched everything with intensity and care and knew everything about the topic before he went into it. So it wasn't so much the topic we talked about, it was the approach. And normally, I don't think I ever turned him down on anything that he wanted to do.
Were there any topics that were not acceptable?
No, I don't think so. I think that anything they suggested doing, they went ahead and did. We had some problems with some of the programs they did. One, for example, statehood for Alaska and Hawaii, which is, you would think now, in retrospect, one of the most innocuous of all. They did it. We had a violent complaint from one Congressman Pillion from Buffalo, New York, who demanded time to answer Ed Murrow on the statehood for Alaska and Hawaii issue. We had a long, long editorial board meeting as to whether we should accede to Congressman Pillion's request for time to answer it or not. The chairman finally laid down the edict that we do it. Now, after 2 hours of discussion with the chairman of the board, and he says, do it, you do it. Well, I went down to Friendly and Murrow, and it's about 8 o'clock at night. They were down in Ed's office and said, we're going to give time to Congressman Pillion. Well, they were both furious, and I think that resulted in a major break between Murrow and the corporate management. But that was the one case where I think we had a real conflict on topics. And I took the Murrow-Friendly point of view. I didn't see why a congressman recognized as one of the least influential in the entire Congress of the United States should have time to answer on a relatively innocuous issue. Now, we caught a lot of flack on things like the Harvest of Shame, for example, which is logical. But I don't think there was any serious question at any point. On the method of operation, when there was anything really controversial, normally Friendly would send up a signal and say, come on and have a look, because I've got some question about this. And I went over to 9th Avenue and had a look. If I still had a question, I would normally say, well, look, let's get Stanton and Paley to come in and have a look at it to see what they think. That seems to be going awfully high on the scale, but since broadcasting was the bulk of CBS's business, and since it was pretty important to keep the broadcasting business going, it seemed important to let them have a look and make up their own minds. And I think they were very much interested in doing it anyway. So we'd take the film over and show it in the viewing room on the 21st floor or whatever it was. Or on some occasions, we even had them come over to 9th Avenue.
During your tenure at CBS News, how many times would you say time was given to a spokesman in order to respond to either news coverage or documentaries on the basis of the Fairness Doctrine? You've mentioned the congressman on this Alaska-Hawaii statehood issue.
How many other times? When you say Fairness Doctrine, now you mean apart from the 315 issue. Because the Fairness Doctrine is that clause within Section
embodied
315.
In 315.
If you're looking at that clause only, I really can't remember very many times. Now, we did give time to the opposition party, depending upon who was in the White House. And I suppose you call that Fairness Doctrine, apart from 315, because there weren't candidates for office.
And you mentioned giving time to McCarthy.
To Congressman Pillion. We gave time to the Secretary of Agriculture, Ezra Taft Benson, once. After we had done a program, and this is interesting, again, it's a Friendly Murrow one on agriculture in Iowa. And they made the point that the small farm is declining in importance. The big farms are taking over the small farms. Benson insisted it was not true and demanded time on the air. We gave Benson the time on the air. And, of course, he was dead wrong, as we know now. And it was right that the small farm was disappearing from view. But Pillion, Benson, chairman of Republican National Committees or Democratic National Committees, Joe McCarthy, after the Murrow Show. You know, there really isn't much more than that. That's about it.
Did you receive a lot of demands for access?
Well, I don't think there were a lot of them. There were some that, you know, that were not really meritorious, as the lawyers would say. But I don't think there were very many, no.
On some of these controversial broadcasts, did you get a lot of flack from your affiliates?
There was some that came in, yeah. I wasn't the target of very much of that. What came in generally came into affiliate relations or directly to corporate management. We got overtones at affiliates meetings. Now, there were two or three station operators in the South who had a feeling that we were a little overboard on integration. But generally, I think the feeling with the affiliates during that period was quite good, and I think they supported most of what we said. They might have disagreed with certain aspects of it, but they were still willing to support us and still willing to accept the program.
Was it your practice then to send documentaries like CBS reports down the line so that affiliates could screen them before air?
Yeah, in many cases it was. If we thought there was anything controversial about them, we did send them down the line. Actually, that started during the war. Started at the time of Detroit race riots in the summer of about 1943, when the network radio network had prepared a half hour on the race riots, or an hour, whatever it was, and they decided right then to send it out because it's sensitive, and we did that constantly. If not the whole show, we at least call attention to the fact that this is sensitive. If you want to see it, we'll play it for you.
While you were at CBS, I know you brought a lot of distinguished people into your news operations. Which ones do you remember best and most fondly?
Well, I suppose the ones I remember, well, not necessarily those I remember best, but those who are best known now to the general public are probably Harry Reasoner and Charlie Kuralt. The story on Reasoner is that when I was at the University of Minnesota on the faculty, I did a night course on extension once and had a young fellow named Harry Reasoner who was sort of a dropout from the university in that course. And he stopped in New York a couple of times to point out he'd been sitting in that course and he might be in for a job sometime. Harry went out to the Philippines with USIA as a public relations officer of some type. I knew he was going. When he got back, he stopped in to say that he'd like a job working for television. I asked him how much experience he had in television. He said, absolutely none. I said, why don't you get some and come on back? 12 months later, entered the office, he came and said, all right, I've had my 12 months experience and here I am. Well, what kind of a job will you take? Anything. So I called John Day down in the news department, said here was a very useful, talented guy. Talk to him and see what could come up. Next thing I knew, Harry had accepted the job at $178 a week, plus some overtime, for a 10-week period of time. And he would move in from Minneapolis to the New York area with his family of either 5 or 6 kids, plus wife, taking a $178 a week job. And of course, he wasn't really gambling because it didn't take more than a couple of weeks before he proved all his talents and skills and so forth, so that he was off and running. Charlie Perrault's story goes like this. When I first got to New York, I had a letter from the news director at WBT in Charlotte, which had been a CBS-owned station. And Jack Nell wrote and said, there's a young fellow in Charlotte, a high school senior, who just won an American Legion Oratory Prize. Why don't you write him a note? It'll make him feel very good. So I wrote, Dear Charles, I'm delighted to know that you won the American Legion Oratory Prize and the very best wishes for a successful career. 7 years later, another letter from Jack Nell at WBT in Charlotte. You undoubtedly don't remember you wrote a letter 7 years ago to one Charles Perrault, who had just won an American Legion Oratory Prize. At that time, he was a senior in high school. Since then, he's graduated from the University of North Carolina School of Journalism and has just won an Ernie Powell Award for feature writing in one of the Charlotte newspapers, I've forgotten, News or Observer. Why don't you write him another letter? So I wrote another letter, you know, the same sort of thing. Got the answer back, what I want most to do is work for CBS News. I'd like very much to come on up there and join your organization. I sent it on down to John Day. Next thing I know, I've got the papers. The sign that Charles Perrault has accepted a job as a writer or assignment man or whatever it was. Now that's the story on Perrault and the reason it. Let me mention a couple of more people before we go on. In 1954, we had the problem in our news department in New York and decided to move our Washington editor up to New York to take over a bigger job. The question arose, who's going to replace him in the Washington Bureau? And I got some leads that there was a fellow in Germany then working for HICOG, the U.S. High Commissioner for Germany, who'd had experience with both AP and UPI and Life magazine, and might be available. So I got in touch with Elmer Lauer, who was in Germany, and he hobbled in on a broken leg. He'd broken playing polo or something or other. So we made a deal for him to come in. Well, there are a lot of these people who came in during that period, some by accident, some by design, but out of it all, we created quite an impressive staff, I think.
You certainly had a group of distinguished journalists working under you during those years. It prompts me to ask you how contracts and salary negotiations were handled with people like Cronkite and Harry Reasoner and Charles Perrault and Dan Shore. Did they represent themselves, or did they all use agents?
Well, I guess I can answer that best by saying that in 1952, between the Republican and Democratic conventions, Walter Cronkite and I were walking up Michigan Avenue together, going out to dinner, and he said, you know, a funny thing happened to me on the way to the hotel today, or however he put it, an agent came around and asked him whether he could represent me. What do you think? And I immediately responded by saying, I think it is much better for you to be represented by an agent than for me to be represented by an agent. You sign up with your agent, and from now on, your agent will talk to my second, who will be the contract man in the business affairs department, and we'll never have to argue between the two of us on any question of salary, working conditions, or anything of the sort. So he signed up with the firm of Gutensticks, and I think now that this is said 27 years later he's still working with glued and sticks. I think we generally followed that point of view. It made much more sense not to get involved in personalities, not to have to sit across the table and argue with talent, but rather to... we had our professionals, the talent contract people and business affairs. They could get their professionals, let them argue the case out. And then we maintained our own relationships, which were largely on substance and not on salaries and working conditions.
Would you give me an idea of the scope of CBS News and the size of the staff when you left in 1961?
Well, the CBS News, I mean the news department staff, which was 14 when I got into it, now they're another 15 or 20 in public affairs, for I suppose a total of 30 to 35. When I left, the full-time staff was in the vicinity of 400 somewhere, a little more than 10 to 1, and I suppose now it's at least three or four times that. The budget when I left, including CBS reports and sports, was in the vicinity of 20 to 25 million, and I suppose that budget now is in excess of 100 million with sports eliminated from it. So that gives you an idea of what's been happening.
Why did you leave CBS?
Well, you know, you get to a certain point. When you're there at the beginning, at the, I guess present at the creation, as Dean Acheson wrote, not the creation of CBS, but the creation of the television wing of it, you've got to keep pressing for things that you want to do, and you got a reputation for pushing hard, and people remember, for example, one thing that I had asked for early was to write off some of the costs of doing our news film operation, I guess selling off the news film. Well, I had to get, I actually started that whole operation for about $2 million a year. I don't know what it costs them now, $50 million? Something in that vicinity, but you got a reputation for being a big spender, you got a reputation for fighting hard here and there and so forth. And eventually, you come to the period when they're still bringing up these old charges of, you know, getting soft from pounding your head against the wall. And you begin to ease off. Now, also, during much of this period, there'd been strong support from Paley and Stanton. It varied somewhat. They're somewhat mercurial. But generally it worked, and when there was a sympathetic president of the television network, which was our principal customer, then at least you got along well. Well, now Jim Aubrey came in as president of the television network, and we began to clash head-to-head and very directly. And it seemed to me at that point as if Paley and Stanton were walking away, and they were not furnishing the support as they had when Lou Cowan or Merle Jones or Jack Van Valkenburg were running a television network. And it became more difficult. In the meantime, Irv Gitlin, who had been a very useful person in our public affairs department, finally decided that he'd accept an offer from NBC and go over to NBC. Pretty soon, Bob Kintner at NBC had taken Elmer Lauer away. And in the process... there was beginning to be an erosion of staff. Huntley and Brinkley were ahead in the ratings, and it became more and more difficult to be able to get support from the management. And they, as a consequence, we got to the position where it wasn't much fun to keep on going. In the meantime, with the ratings going into a slump, Huntley and Brinkley were really taking hold, and it was very difficult to try to determine what to do about Huntley Brinkley. I was sure that we couldn't win with Doug Edwards because with all the charm he has and the intelligence and the ability at the same time, he wasn't an abrasive enough personality, not a commanding enough personality, not dominating enough to get the ratings leadership back. So I started making moves to make a change, and I thought I was all set once to get Cronkite into the job. This would have been June of 1960, but Aubrey vetoed it because he had some other candidates that he wanted to put into it. I didn't want his candidates because I thought they were show business candidates, and I didn't think we could live with them.
Who were they?
Well, one is a county commissioner in Los Angeles County now, a son of former Senator Schwellenbach from Washington. The name he now uses is Baxter Ward. He was one of them. I think Cleet Roberts who does some work in Los Angeles, was another one. And Mike Wallace was the third that Aubrey would like to have had. And I didn't really feel that any one of them would have filled the bill for what we wanted. I wanted Cronkite to do it, and we got into this lengthy negotiation, and nothing happened on that. The corporation apparently got disturbed about the whole thing, and I was hailed into Stanton's office one day and said, in order to ease your problems for you, we're setting up a news committee. And Dick Salant will be the chairman of the news committee. I said, does that mean then that I work through Salant? And he said, yes. Well, that, I said, is totally unacceptable as far as I'm concerned. Everything has been going well so far, but that won't work out, so I better start finding something else to do. And he argued only mildly about it, which indicated that there was some dissatisfaction there. In the meantime, Time and Life had been asking me about coming on over. They had a couple of things in mind they were interested in. And then I had an approach to become the head of Radio Free Europe, which is ironic in view of the fact that I later did it. But that's only Radio Free Europe, not that, and Radio Liberty. And that involved the CIA, Alan Dulles, and Archie Alexander, and so forth. And they asked me whether I'd mind if they talked to Frank Stanton. And I said, no, not a bit. So Frank then encouraged me to take it, which means that I might as well find something else to do. So I decided in the meantime that I didn't want the Free Europe job, because it would have meant living in Munich at that point, and it would have been complicated, and with all the changes occurring, I didn't think that was right. But Time had an idea that they were generating a lot of profits overseas, that any profits overseas brought back would have to be charged large capital gains taxes, corporate profits taxes. And so, as a consequence, they'd like to reinvest that money, and they had begun to see that television was a very interesting business, and thought they had a couple of chances to get into it. So they wanted to know if they couldn't find somebody who could help Time Inc. get itself involved in some foreign investments, using up some of those profits being generated, and would I come in and do it? Well, the fact is that it sounded rather attractive in getting out of a situation which was getting increasingly complicated. In the meantime, RFE had asked about the other job, and Stanton knew that I was leaving, so that, it was very simple just to say, oh, goodbye, here I'm going.
Before we move over to Time Inc., let me ask you about the truth or the falsity of the reports that you served as the liaison between CBS and the CIA.
Well, that's gotten a lot of publicity, and you can't call it liaison because it wasn't really that. What the story is that in the middle, or the early to middle 1950s, during the period of the real Cold War, the CIA, under the supervision direction of Alan Dulles, was working fairly closely with major American media, not in terms of anything surreptitious, not in terms of spying or anything of the sort, but exchanges of information and that kind of thing. I discovered after a trip to Sweden that a stringer who was working for us in Sweden was at the same time a full-time employee of CIA. We discontinued using him, but at the same time I was asked if the CIA could buy film and if they could find out from me when correspondents were coming back and if they might talk to them and that kind of thing. Would I tip them off on any interesting film? And I didn't see anything wrong with that at all, so that I had a regular contact with the CIA on that basis. In addition to that, once a year, when our foreign correspondents came in from Europe, Alan Dulles invited us all to come down to Washington and have dinner either at his home or at the Alibi Club, which is a favorite club of his. And we had delightful dinner, excellent food, superb wines, and conversation to match. And the conversation, I think, probably was even more useful to us than it was to them, because there were no confidentialities exchanged at all. It was just a matter of background. And I think that was all to our advantage, to know what the CIA people were thinking, because their knowledge of things around the world was pretty good. On one occasion, I was told by one of our correspondents that one of our stringers